So in 2012, I had managed to save up a rather meager sum of money, and I was advised that I shouldn't just sit on it, that I should actually make that money work for me in some way. Now, I've already told you before that I really love numbers, I love math, and so I have a particular affinity for poker, but I figured out that if I just taken my whole savings to a casino, that was going to be frowned upon. So instead, I chose the stock market, because there you could just replace the word gamble with investment, and everyone's cool with it, right? So that was the idea there. So, you know, if you have anyone in your life who's really good at financial planning, they'll tell you that if you're going to invest in the stock market, you should really pick like a good mutual fund, someone who's going to diversify your portfolio for you. But that's boring. I wanted to go in myself, and so I chose a stock that I wanted to invest in. I didn't have a lot of money, so I pretty much threw it all into one little upstart company, but really nothing was happening for me. Until in January 2013, something changed. I saw a dip in Apple stock. Now, if you'd been following Apple to that point, it was on this rise. It just kept rising. People were wondering if there was any limit to how high Apple stock could go, but then it dipped. They had like one quarter of slightly less than expected performances, and suddenly this thing is tanking like 40% of its value. And I'm certain that there's no way it's going to stay there. And so I make the decision to pull all my money out of the startup and go into Apple stock, because I'm certain that's going to buoy back and I'm going to get my money. And so at the time, in January 2013, it had dropped to $71 a share. Before that, it was hovering about 100. The math is actually a little funny because they did a stock split later, but this is what it would have been if it was today's values. And by August 2014, it had gone back up to about $100 a share, the target point. And I sold it there for a 44% gain. In a year and a half, that actually is not too bad. I was pretty proud of myself. Just for fun, if I had held on to that stock to today, it would have gone to 150, which is still great. It's not the most amazing thing that's ever happened, but still, I would have gained a lot more money if I'd held it rather than sold it. If I sold it, here's the real problem. The problem wasn't that I invested in Apple. Apple worked out really well for me. The problem was that the little upstart company I pulled my money out of was this little DVD swapping service called Netflix. In January 2013, these shares went for about $14 a share. Actually, they also did a 7-to-1 stock split, so it's a little bit odd if you go back in your history, but that's what it would have been in today's terms. By August 2014, that had swelled to $68 a share, a 386% gain. If I had held on to that stock to today, the current price of a Netflix share is $291, nearly 2,000% gain from the stocks I held right before 2013. I didn't hold on to those Netflix stocks, and hence I still work here. And I really wish I was making this up, but no, that's my life. Do not take investment advice from me. That's not what I'm here for, all right? At least not in terms of finances. See, the interesting thing about entering the stock market is you have to place your trust in a company. You have to hope that that company is going to make it, that they can do something with your money so that you actually get a return on your investment. And you could do all the due diligence you want to try and figure out if a company is going to be profitable for you, but it's really, really challenging, which is why most people diversify. But here we are, looking at Luke. And in many ways, you can summarize Luke's whole gospel kind of like this. People are investing in the wrong thing. Up to this point, through the first 18 chapters or so of Luke, you see Jesus going to people who are in some really dire straits, a lot of them. Or some of them don't realize just in how dire of a strait they are actually in. And he's telling them that there's something else that they could invest in. Something else is going to have a payoff way different than Apple stock. Something that's going to be pretty incredible and life-changing. And some people accept the message, some people don't. Because it's difficult, right? In this life, we have to put our trust in something. But where do we place that trust? And why do we do it? Go ahead and turn in your Bibles to Luke chapter 19, verse 28. That's where we're going to be today. This story that we're going to read is sometimes called the triumphal entry. Other times we call it the Palm Sunday message. So if you follow the church calendar, and by church calendar, I don't mean Rose Drive events. I mean the calendar of things that the church across the world sets to kind of go through all the different parts of the Bible. Then this would usually be a message that we do a couple Sundays from now. You probably know at least two parts of the church calendar because Christmas and Easter are based on that, right? And so the week before Easter, usually churches will give a Palm Sunday message, this section of scripture that we're going to look at, because it starts what we call Holy Week. Because from this point forward, Jesus is entering into Jerusalem and moving toward the cross and ultimately his resurrection. That's all going to happen. And it's going to happen in a very short span. And so as a church, we typically set that Sunday up as Palm Sunday. Now, there's two reasons why we're not going to do it quite like that this year. One is this. We're in Luke. There's four different gospels with four different versions of these same events. Luke doesn't actually mention palm branches, so it'd be a little bit weird to call it Palm Sunday. The other thing is this. There's a lot of great stories between Jesus' entrance into Jerusalem and the cross and his resurrection. We don't want to miss those this year. And so we have to start Palm Sunday a little bit early. And we're going to start it this week so that we can hit a couple of these key episodes that lead to the cross over the next several weeks. So I encourage you to come back to finish out this series with us as we look at the rest of Luke leading to Jesus' death and resurrection. Now, there's four different gospels, and each of these gospels paint a slightly different picture of Jesus. It's not that they have a different Jesus that they're talking about. It's just that each of the gospels are able to highlight different events that happened or different little bits of what Jesus said in his teachings and his theology. And together, they give a really solid picture of who Jesus is. It's actually one of the cool blessings of the Bible that we have four separate accounts of the life of Jesus that blend together so well and give us such a full picture of the life of Jesus. Now, in this series, we've really just been focusing on Luke's account. So we really haven't paid that much attention to Matthew, Mark, and John. There's other details that we've just omitted in following Luke's narrative. But as we've gone throughout all this, we've really seen Jesus jump into people's lives, challenge their assumptions, and make some friends and enemies along the way. And today, when Jesus is going to enter into Jerusalem and start this thing that we call Holy Week, he's not doing so as a neutral party. Everybody is looking to see what Jesus is going to do. Everyone has heard about this Jesus. They know about his miracles. They know about his teachings. And they're going to anxiously wait to see what Jesus is going to do when he enters Jerusalem. Is he going to try to take some power for himself? Is he going to challenge the status quo? This is the seat of power here for the Israelite people in Jerusalem. What is he going to do? And no one's quite sure. So we're going to do a little bit of background work here before we have Jesus actually enter the city, because we have to kind of know what he walked into. Jesus walked into a city whose name means, basically, city of peace, or abode of peace. That's the kind of the breakdown meaning of Jerusalem. That last part, Salem, is based on a Jewish word called shalom. Shalom was their word for peace, but it meant a lot more than just peace in the sense of there's no military conflict. It meant peace in the sense of wholeness, that everything was the way it was supposed to be. And that was Jerusalem. It was the city of everything being the way it was supposed to be. Only it wasn't. The Jewish people were occupied by a foreign government that they didn't particularly like. They felt oppressed. Many of them sometimes even felt oppressed by their own religious leaders. Peace wasn't to be had in the city of peace. And they all wanted it. And a number of different people were willing to invest a lot of their life into finding ways to bring shalom back. And a lot of them had chosen some very interesting investments. The iPhone wasn't even a gleam in Steve Jobs' eye yet, so it wasn't an investment in the stock market. It was an investment in something else that they thought would bring them shalom, wholeness. So I'm going to give you two groups of people that were heavily invested in the thing that they thought would bring them peace. All right. So the first was this. They're kind of the zealots. Now, this wasn't everybody. It was actually a small group of people. But these zealots really believed that God was going to bring about a mighty military victory that was going to expel Rome from Jerusalem forever. And they'd be able to reclaim their identity as a national people. And they had some Old Testament reason for this. All throughout the Old Testament prophecies, you see God talking about destroying Israel's enemies. And so the zealots really clung to that, and really everybody did. Everyone really believed that God was going to expel Israel's enemies. And so if you look at, say, Zechariah chapter 9, this is one of those passages there. You can turn there if you want, but we're going to go through it kind of quickly. In Zechariah chapter 9, verses 1 to 8, you have a whole bunch of cities that God ultimately says, I'm going to overthrow. I'm not going to read all these verses because then I have to pronounce these names. And I don't want to do that. But these are the names of the cities that ultimately God says, I'm going to overthrow. And now since it's Old Testament prophecy, these are old cities, and many of them have actually already disappeared from the map already. But when these people, these Israelites, they read these Old Testament prophecies and they read about these cities that God was promising to overthrow, they didn't read it so much in terms of these old cities. They read it in terms of their present experience. And their present experience was only one city, and it was Rome. So you might get something like this. In Zechariah 9, verse 3, you see these words. Tyre has built herself a stronghold. She has heaped up silver like dust and gold like the dirt of the streets. But the Lord will take away her possessions and destroy her power on the sea, and she will be consumed by fire. And now for the people reading this at the time of Jesus, they would have taken these Old Testament passages and they would have in their heads reread it this way. Rome has built herself a stronghold. Rome has heaped up silver like dust and gold like the dirt of the streets. But the Lord will take away Rome's possessions and destroy Rome's power on the sea, and Rome will be consumed by fire. Because that was their enemy. And they believed that just as God promised to overthrow enemies in the Old Testament, that promise still clung to their time and place. So something like verse 6, you would get something like this. A mongrel people will occupy Ashdod, and I'll put an end to the pride of the Philistines. And once again, they just replace those words. A mongrel people will occupy Rome, and I'll put an end to the pride of the Romans. And they clung to this. And here's the thing. Strictly speaking, their way of interpreting the Old Testament scriptures here wasn't really wrong. Because when you read prophecy, it never really is just about the future. It's about the past and the present and the future colliding into the timeless promises of God. And so they were right in reading this, that God was going to help them overcome their enemies. And today, for us, when we read Old Testament passages like this, we can read that with the same assurance, that we have a God who helps us to overcome our enemies, the things that are preventing us from having a relationship with God, the things that are in our way. The problem, though, is that sometimes the way that God handles our enemies isn't the way that we wish he would. In verse 8, you see this. But I will encamp at my temple to guard it against marauding forces. Never again will an oppressor overrun my people, for now I am keeping watch. That's how those section of verses end there with verse 8. That after all of those cities are overthrown, God will encamp at the temple and no one will ever enter it again from the outside. They clung to this. Now, this temple was actually in Jerusalem. So if you're sitting in Jerusalem reading these things, you know this temple that they're talking about. You can see it from your window. And you're hopeful that God one day will bring about someone who will defend you from the outside. And now all these people are looking at the life and the ministry of Jesus, seeing all the miraculous things he's done, and they're thinking to themselves, this could actually be the guy. This might be the guy who overthrows Rome, who brings us our military peace that we're looking for, who brings us our national identity back. And so those zealots who are there are actually trying to get Jesus to be this guy. That's what they want. Now, that's not everybody, but as these zealots are getting more and more traction for their ideas, more and more people in the crowd seem to think, maybe this is Jesus. Now, there's another group of people. They're going to be in the crowd today, and this group of people are the religious leaders, or the Pharisees, as we sometimes call them. It's a group of them. And these religious leaders have a different thing that they're investing their time and energy into. They're not looking for a military coup. They really believe that they will find shalom, they will find peace by the right religious practices. That if we just live our life rightly enough, correctly enough, if we follow God's law, that's what will ultimately bring in shalom and peace. And they weren't terribly off either. I mean, you see that in the Old Testament, that God says when you follow his decrees, that it will bring you life, it will bring you peace. And so they were clinging to that. But they were also clinging to their position. They had some pretty high position in society, a position that sort of depended on Rome staying in power. So they did not like the idea of a military coup, because if there was one, they were all going to lose their positions. So the religious leaders and the Pharisees wanted nothing to do with a military uprising. That was not their gig. And so these two groups of people, they're investing either in this military conquest or in this kind of right religious way of living. Those are some of the things that they're investing themselves into, hoping that it will bring peace. And it's into this world, into this city, that Jesus will enter. Into these mindsets, into these hopes that Jesus is going to break in and give them something else to think about. And so let's read our passage today. After Jesus had said this, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. As he approached Bethphage and Bethany at the hill called the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples, saying to them, "Go to the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you will find a colt tied there, which no one has ever ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, 'Why are you untying it?' say, 'The Lord needs it.' Those who were sent ahead went and found it, just as he had told them. As they were untying the colt, its owners asked them, "Why are you untying the colt?" They replied, "The Lord needs it." They brought it to Jesus, threw their cloaks on the colt, and put Jesus on it. Now, there's a lot of really cool stuff here about the idea of Jesus knowing this was going to happen in advance and about this idea of who really owns this colt. Some really great sermon material for another day because I just don't have time. All I need you to know right now is that Jesus is going to enter into Jerusalem on a donkey, all right? A colt, a young donkey that hasn't yet been ridden. So this thing's probably just a little bit too small even to ride on a donkey, and that would already be a little bit odd. So new, actually, that the disciples have to throw their cloaks over it so that Jesus actually has something to sit on, because this has never had a saddle. And so Jesus is walking in on this very small animal, not the regal horse that you would expect. And people are trying to figure out what to make of it. Because if he had came in this big steed, people would assume he was making a statement about kingship. I'm here to be your new king. I mean, that's what kings did. They came in on these big horses with these big processionals saying, "I am here now, I am your king." Maybe Jesus was doing that, but the animal was just a little bit odd. Maybe he was trying to make another statement altogether, but no one actually could quite figure out what was happening. In fact, if you read John's account of the same story, it actually says the disciples did not understand what Jesus was doing. It baffled them. They couldn't understand why Jesus would come in on this donkey. It made zero sense to them whatsoever. It seemed so odd to them, so unusual. No one could quite make sense of it. And so now the crowd has to kind of figure out what to do with what they're seeing. Do they worship this man riding this really small donkey? Do they fear him? Do they ignore him? What is the crowd going to do? Well, verse 36, we get an answer. As he went along, people spread their cloaks on the road. When he came near the place where the road goes down the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of disciples began joyfully to praise God in loud voices for all the miracles they had seen. "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest." There it is. Jesus is that peace, and he is our King. Now, what's important to know at this point is that Jesus doesn't actually say these things about himself. These words are coming from his disciples and from this large crowd that we learn is also getting involved in the action. Lots of people who are saying that they want Jesus to be their king. There's a little bit of confusion as to what that means, because everyone's got a slightly different idea. There's a bunch of people in this crowd who really want him to be a military king. And there's others who are trying to follow Jesus' ways. And while they all are here acknowledging this important moment when Jesus is coming in, it seems very positive. What's going on in people's heads is actually very convoluted. And it's really concerning to some people. This is verse 39. This only appears in Luke's gospel, by the way, and everything else at this point only appears in Luke's gospel. Some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples." They saw what the disciples were saying, that Jesus is a king, and this was very scary to them. Because so far, that particular claim hadn't been levied. And so now the Pharisees had to deal with this fact that people were calling Jesus their king. You can't do that. Because those people already have a king. It's the emperor. And so if you declare that you have a new king, what you are basically doing is starting a rebellion. And the Pharisees want no part of that at all. And I think they honestly believe that Jesus didn't either. And so they hear what the disciples are going and saying, and they go to Jesus and they say, "Jesus, your disciples are like turning up to 11 over here. Can they just dial it down a little bit? We have our disagreements. We don't always see eye to eye, but you know that this is dangerous, right? Like, if your disciples keep talking like this, it's going to lead to rebellion. It's going to lead to destruction. So can you just tell them to just tone it down?" And I really think that they expected Jesus to say yes. But here's his response. "I tell you," he replied, "if they keep quiet, the stones will cry out." There is a truth that can't be denied. Jesus is the king. Some of his disciples are starting to understand it. Some of the people in the crowd are calling him king, even if they don't understand what they mean when they're saying that word. But that's a truth. Jesus is king. And that truth can't be squelched for much longer, to the point where inanimate creation will declare the truth if people do not. As inconvenient as it might be for the Pharisees in that moment, Jesus really is king. And it's this claim that's going to result in all of the crazy events that will happen over the next few episodes we'll talk about over the coming weeks. Events that will ultimately lead to people wanting to try Jesus, ultimately lead him to a cross and to being resurrected again. Because there's a competing claim about who is going to be the king of your life. Now, in this moment, it seems like the crowd is really on Jesus' side. And if it kept going this way, then things would work out a lot better in the New Testament than perhaps we actually see, at least from an earthly standpoint. Because what will happen pretty soon, and Jesus knows this, is that the very people who today call him king will but in a few moments call him traitor and seek to end his life. Because their investment in Jesus' way is actually almost nothing. Their investment is in other things, military power, political power. And when Jesus seems to start to lose influence in those spheres, they're going to pull their money back out, so to speak. That's not where they're going to put their hope. And ultimately, Jesus is going to be tried for it. And here's why I like Luke's version of this story. Each gospel actually has a fun way of telling the story, but Luke gives us one little detail that we don't get in any of the other gospels, and it's Jesus' response right after coming into the city, how Jesus responds to all these events. It goes like this, in verse 41. As he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it and said, "If you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes." Jesus is entering the city of peace. He is peace himself. And yet when he comes through these gates, no one recognizes it. They cannot see the shalom that's directly in front of them for all of the other investments that they have made. And Jesus knows this. In some of the other gospels, it almost seems like a twist, a plot twist, when the crowd turns against Jesus, but not in this one. Because in Luke's gospel, we already know Jesus knows the future. He sees what's going to happen. He knows how fickle that crowd is going to be. And it's not anger that burns in him, but sorrow. Sorrow for this city that he cares so much for. They just missed it. It was right there, and they missed it. And now, actually, they were going to experience the very opposite of peace. This is what you see in verses 43 and 44. The days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side. They will dash you to the ground, you and the children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you. And these events, by the way, happened just a little while after Jesus left the earth, actually. This was something that really did happen. There really was sort of a military coup that occurred, and so Rome had to squash that. And so there was huge devastation laid to the city of Jerusalem and to the temple and to the people there. Why they thought that perhaps they'd get this military victory that's going to help them overcome Rome. Rome was actually going to beat Jerusalem. That was going to happen. And people were going to be really confused as to how this matched with their Old Testament promises that they were so sure that God was going to deliver by kicking Rome out. It was going to be a very confusing time for a lot of them. But here's the thing. Jesus, as much as he cared about the people of Jerusalem, as much as he cared about bringing peace, he didn't want to bring about peace through all the means everyone was telling him he should. He had a much bigger vision in mind. His vision didn't just include creating a gigantic world war. He had something bigger. What's tragic is, if those same people who had read Zechariah 9 verses 1 to 8 had gone just a little bit further and keyed in on some of the other things that the prophet was saying, they would have unmistakably noticed what Jesus was doing. This is Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9. "Rejoice greatly, daughter Zion. Shout, daughter Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and victorious, lowly and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey." John's gospel does say that it was later that the disciples understood that when Jesus came into the gate on a donkey, that this is what he was referring to, that he was setting himself up to be this humble king, that he really was making a statement about his kingship, but it was the kind of kingship that was going to work completely differently than anything people had seen before. This was what his kingship was going to look like in verse 10. "I will take away the chariots from Ephraim and the war horses from Jerusalem, and the battle bow will be broken. He will proclaim peace to the nations. His rule will extend from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth." Ephraim's a subset of Israel, so he's going to take away all the instruments of war from Israel. They're not going to have anything to fight with, because the peace that he brings is so complete that war is a relic of the past. that it's not about conquering your enemies, it's actually about bringing peace across all the nations, from sea to sea, all peoples together. They missed that vision. And in the process, they missed exactly what Jesus was doing. And now they're going to miss out on peace, on shalom. And that is why Jesus was weeping, because the city had missed peace. Each of us in our lives have to invest into something to bring us peace. It's just kind of part of being human. We have to look for those things that are going to give us some sense of comfort, some sense of identity, some sense of wholeness, some sense of things being the way they're supposed to be. And that could be a number of different things. It could be a number of different ways, the different things that we try to invest in. And all of them are distractions from Jesus. And when you read the rest of Luke's gospel, he mentions a lot of them. You see people who are wealthy who cling to wealth instead of peace. You see people who cling to political power or religious power instead of peace. My small group right now is going through a book called The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. It is not a marriage manual. It's this image of people who are in hell but are given this opportunity to visit heaven and even stay there if they so desire. But there are many people who won't leave hell because in hell they can actually imagine anything they want. They can imagine these giant mansions, but they have no substance and the rain goes right through it. But they cling to those things that they've imagined. Or some of them get to the very gates of heaven, but they cannot go any further, not because they're not invited, but because they cannot leave behind their desire for fame or their desire for personal appearance or for their desire to cling to things that they clung to on earth. And in the process, they miss peace. And it's tragic. For each of us, we find ourselves in that situation sometimes where we cling to something that isn't the right investment. We call that idolatry. Idolatry is when we put our hope in something that cannot actually bring us shalom. And really, that's anything but Jesus and the relationship with God that Jesus shows us. And so today, as we look at this triumphal entry and the ways in which people were clinging to their idols and missed peace itself in the process, let's not be that people. Let's be a people who indeed lay our cloaks before the king. Say, come in. Be the king of my life, but not because I want you to fulfill my selfish agenda, but because I want to follow you wherever you go, even if that road leads to a cross. As a people who follow him all the way, we're going to find that it's Jesus and Jesus alone who brings us shalom. God, we are so grateful that you came to this world to live among us, to die for us, that we can have real peace. I pray, God, that we would be a people who invest wholly in you, in your words, in your teachings, in your relationship, in your salvation. Because God, you are all that is worth it. You are everything. And so we submit all that we are to your kingship today. We lay our cloaks before you. In your name we pray. Amen.